UK Wine Show, show number 136. Xavier Rousset on food and wine matching. Merry Christmas. As that big meal with family gets closer, we're talking about food and wine matching.
And in the news, fair trade first for Fairhills, America overtakes France in the UK, and Moët's buys Champagne House.
Merry Christmas and welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 136 for the 19th of December 2008. My name's Chris Scott and on this week's festive season we're talking about food and wine matching. We're back talking with Xavier Rousset, award-winning sommelier and co-owner of Texture Restaurant in London. We find out about the do's and don'ts of food matching. In the spotlight we continue our look at wine flavours, this time looking at the aging effects on older wines. And in this week's quote, "Claret is the liquor for boys, port for men, but he who aspires to be a hero must drink brandy." Clues throughout the show, answers at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. South African wine company Origin Wine, owner of Fairtrade Fairhills brand, has become the first Fairtrade wine to cover all three Fairtrade wine-producing countries, with production facilities and community support projects now in South Africa, Argentina and Chile. An export company has been set up based in Curico, called Chilean Vineyards SA, and has been certified as a licensed Fairtrade exporter. The move follows the demise of the Los Robles cooperative in Chile, of which four ex-producers will be supplying the Fairhills Chile brand, as well as own-label Fairtrade wine. Origin has also recruited Paula Botero, ex-winemaker of Los Robles. The co-op will launch a range of Sauvignon Blanc, Carmenere and Shiraz Cabernet Merlot in early 2009.
I've always thought Fairtrade as a grassroots organisation. Now, with what is in effect a multinational company dominating the space, it doesn't sit very well with me. Speaking of multinational companies dominating the space, what's the story with America and France, Jane?
For the first time ever, American wine sales have overtaken French in the UK. In the year to November 2008, sales of American wine in the off-trade grew 3% to £781 million, while French wine sales fell 3% to £780 million. This puts France third in the wine consumption league table, with Australia in first place with 23% of the market, and Italy in fourth. 95% of American wine is produced in California, and crucial to the success of American wines is Californian Rosé, which has been a hit with British women, with sales up 17% in the year to October. This is against a decline of 5% in sales of French Rosé. The Californian Wine Institute puts the success down to marketing and finding out what the customer wants, something they say the Californians do better than the French.
It is amazing the power of cheap, sweet rosé on wine drinkers. America, for all its high-end, super expensive wines, still dominates the UK market with well-made but wholly unexciting average rosé. But perhaps the slip now to third place in the UK charts for France will have them thinking less about the quality of their wines, but maybe to concentrate on marketing the wines and giving people what they actually want. Like Australia in the UK, the US is being driven by high volumes of a small number of brands. One day France may be able to organise themselves to meet this challenge, but I think their ranking in the UK charts will be a lot worse before France starts working together. But one of the big French wine companies are expanding. What's going on there, Jane?
Moët Hennessy has bought Montaudon Champagne, a family-run business founded in 1891 and based in Reims. The company produces a high-quality champagne and exports to 25 countries. Moët Hennessy say the acquisition will help to increase their champagne reserves, as well as add to the portfolio of prestigious brands, which include Dom Pérignon, Moët & Chandon, Veuve Clicquot and Krug. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. How are you getting on with the quote? I thought the reference to port, being Christmas time, was probably the most relevant quote I could find. Claret is the liquor for boys, port for men, but he who aspires to be a hero must drink brandy. Again, this is a quote from a book, but it's a biography by one of England's most famous literary figures, who lived between 1709 and 1784. This Englishman claimed to grow up in the poverty, but came from a wealthy family, and is reputed to write one of the most important English books of all time. Any ideas? Well, next up, we've got the spotlight looking at flavours. A couple of weeks ago, we started looking at flavours, and this week we're going to be looking at the flavours associated with ageing wines. At many a wine tasting I've run, guests have gone off and returned with a bottle of wine that they've been keeping for many years, and they ask, when should I drink it? I often answer, today! But it's not because I want to drink the wine. Often I wish I had said, drink it 5 to 10 years ago. Aging of wine is confusing to most people, and when to drink a wine is even harder. A few people understand that tannins and acidity all decrease as the wine ages, and along with sugar act as a preservative. So different concentrations of these will change the speed that the wine develops. But perhaps the least understood is why flavours in the wine change. Now the final wine that goes into the bottle is made up of flavours from fruit, these are called primary flavours or aromas, the winemaking process, such as being exposed to oak. At the time of bottling, these flavours are not stable. In fact, wine is like any other fruit or vegetable product, it's slowly decaying. Alcohol, acidity, tannins, sugar all help preserve the wine, but ultimately the wine will break down to a more stable state. It's not surprising then that the fresh fruit flavours fade and earthy, animal, savoury flavours develop in the wine. This is called the aged bouquet of wines, as opposed to the aroma for young wines. Many white wines will develop a honeyed note as they age. Bordeaux reds can develop a tobacco, cedary, pencil shaving bouquet. But how does the wine change? At its basics, the flavour in wine is caused by a molecule called a phenol. In most reds, the phenols come from the skins, but the grape juice does contain some phenolic compounds, but nowhere near as many as on the skin. Phenols, over time, can react with other components in the wine. These new molecules then interact in new ways with other molecules, slowly changing through a number of states before becoming more stable. As the molecule changes, the aroma may change or even completely vanish. This is often said the wine to be closed. Confusingly, what can appear to be a dead wine can spring back to life as those phenols responsible for flavour change again into another phenolic compound which has a bouquet. The development and change of these flavour molecules are known as pathways and are governed not only by the starting point but the conditions in the bottle as it ages. There are hundreds if not thousands of different pathways occurring and interacting in a single bottle of wine. This is why it can be very difficult to tell how a wine will evolve in the bottle. The only sure way to know what a wine will evolve into is watching an older wine from the same region made the same way from a similar vintage. That ends this week looking at flavours. But before we get into the interview, we have a couple more clues for the quote. Claret is a liquor for boys, port for men, but he who aspires to be a hero must drink brandy. Any ideas? The person who said the quote wrote the first English dictionary, and he's already been quoted in our show. In fact, I used a reference to the fact that he was mimicked in Blackadder. As the quote says, claret is an English term for French Bordeaux. And according to Oz Clarke in his new book, Bordeaux, which I'm currently reading and will review just after Christmas, claret is a food wine. But what is a food wine? Next, we're going to be talking to Xavier Rousset, award-winning sommelier and co-owner of Texture Restaurant. Xavier was a protege of Gérard Bassat and rose to head sommelier at the Hôtel du Vin under his guidance. At 22, Xavier won the UK Sommelier of the Year award competition and gained his Master's Sommelier qualification in the process. Let's have a chat to Xavier on wine and food matching. Hi, I'm here with Xavier Rousset. Yeah. You're the sommelier at Texture Restaurant in London. We're going to be talking a wee bit about wine and food matching.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's everybody wants to talk about, when it comes to a sommelier, to talk about food and wine matching. What was your, any specific question? Is it as a subject or?
I think, well, first of all, what are the golden rules with wine and food matching? You know, what do you look for when you've got a dish and your chef's created a new dish, mm-hmm. and he said, right, Xavier, we need to sell this and you need to be able to put some wine syrup. Right. You taste, I presume you get to taste the dish?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And what do you do when you're looking
to Well, try? I mean, you need to balance, is everything. Like balance in a dish, balance in the wine, and if the two balances, the food and wine matching is great. What you need is, if you get power, there's a quick, big rule, in a way. A powerful dish, powerful wine. You know, light dish, light wine.
So you get the weight of the wine.
You get the weight of the wine. The way I usually do is texture the main component of the dish, whereby it could be a monkfish or a steak, will reflect on the texture of the wine that goes with it. And what comes around it, the sauce and all the ingredients around that main dish, will then give me the fruit, sort of fruit flavor, the flavors I'm looking for in the wine as well.
Okay.
So monkfish, which is quite a chunky fish, you need pretty a rich bottle of white wine, if you wish. Now, if the monkfish comes with, say, it could be chorizo or something red and a bit meaty, you can even go for red wine.
A lighter red wine?
Red wine. Or at the moment at work, we do it with a lot of citrus, grapefruit and passion fruit for the monkfish with a risotto, which is very refreshing. So you need something a bit chunky for the white as a texture. So Viognier could do well. Mm-hmm. Sort of, you know, idea. And then you get this grapefruit, those little, you know, like I said, passion fruits of Viognier will definitely match. Roussanne could be another one.
Yep.
So you see, I worked those sort of way. Now, the monkfish was coming with a meaty flavor to it. I've tried once monkfish in a good restaurant in the UK and beef chick mixed together.
Beef chick?
I know, beef chick and monkfish.
Well, no, I don't know what beef chick is.
Beef cheek. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And it was mixed together. So I'll definitely go for red there. Probably something from Italy with a lovely acidity to cut through the it was a slow-cooked beef cheek. So, I mean, you know, it really, there's no, that's the bigger rule I do for myself. But the main thing to remember is what you like is the main thing, it's important, and that's why I usually ask people, what's your favorite style of wine?
Yep.
And then see what they've ordered and go from there.
Okay, so the weight of the wine, the weight of the dish, and then the
flavors into the dish will match the flavors into the wine.
Of the sauce.
Yeah, for instance, yeah.
Okay. When you talk about texture or the weight, I presume you're talking about things like alcohol levels, glycol levels?
Yeah, into the wine, yeah, how powerful it could be. The tannin structure for the reds.
Yep.
For instance, a chicken will not go so well. Some Swiss settings are very tannic. Red wines, where, for instance, the blood of a steak cooked rare, the protein in the blood will marry very, very well with the tannins of the wine. They combine extremely well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that gives you another, idea of what can go, what can't, really.
Because protein cuts through tannins, doesn't it?
Yeah, mellow the tannins, yeah.
Let's talk a wee bit about tannins, because, they're a big structure, particularly in red wines. And we talked about proteins.
Uh-huh.
What sort of foods are high in protein that would go with tannic wines?
Well, I mean, the beef is probably the most famous one.
Yep.
And
a rare beef as well.
Yeah, rare. You need the blood, but the protein. Lamb could do well. I mean, lamb is a well-known combination where lamb from Pauillac, which is a good area for lamb, or Pyrenees, goes
or
there with Bordeaux, or New Zealand. But so it has to go with Cabernet from Hawke's Bay. Then, yeah? Cabernet Merlot from Hawke's Bay. But so that's another classic where the young Pauillac would have a good structure and high tannin structure. So, those are the classic. But again, it's
some
done
cheeses,
to...
Some cheeses, though.
Ah, cheese. Ooh. To me, I'd love and to see, for instance, but it will take time, when you do a cheese board, it's not possible to match anything with a cheese board. And the reason why people go for red wine, because that's usually the leftover from the main course.
Yeah.
Or there's always this power thing. You never go back to something lighter after you had a pretty heavy red. So it's tricky for a white wine to go afterwards. But ideally, you do one single cheese with one single wine.
Mm.
So a goat cheese will go with such and such. Époisse will go with something else. So you really have, there's more and more restaurants who do a dish out of a cheese as a cheese course. And then you marry that to one specific glass of sherry, port, white, red wine, champagne, whatever you want.
Okay, because generally...
But it's hard to get the cheese board, and say, what do you suggest as a glass of red or white? Because on the same plate, you've got blue, goat, hard, soft, all sorts of, from Camembert to Stilton. I mean, it's very complicated. And sometimes it can get this kind of metallic taste to it as well. For instance, Camembert and red wine, you get a slightly metallic finish to it, which is not so pleasant.
Mm.
you know, so that really each cheese almost should have a specific wine.
I had an interview with someone a wee while ago, and they sort of said that, like, you know, food and wine matching, yeah, it can be divine, it can be horrible, but most of the time, it doesn't matter so much.
Well, I've been told by a good sommelier, good quality food, good quality wine, and you're a happy man.
Yeah.
I tend to, you know, absolutely agree on that. Because by thinking about it too much, you might even lose the pleasure of, if you think too much about what you're eating and drinking, you might lose the whole pleasure of doing it. And usually, we are discussing on a, now around the table, before having dinner, you talk about maybe the wine you're having or the food you're having, and both for 2 or 3 minutes, but you got another topic of conversation, you're really enjoying yourself, the atmosphere plays a big part, how you are, if you're tired or not. I'd love one day to the tasting and different atmosphere into the room and see how your perspective of the how you perceive the wine. It'd be totally different from a dark room to a noisy room to something with a bit of smell into the room, or make you run 5 kilometers, then you come and taste the wine, because you know you will lose a lot of salt while running, so your palate is not adjusted to, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
If you sweat, you lose a bit of salt.
Yep, yep.
So anything, you know, will change your taste bud dramatically.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Oh, it'd be interesting one day. I just need to put it on paper and work out, how do you call that, like a theme of the day or tasting, but in different conditions.
Yep.
In the cold, in the warm.
Moving on, we were talking about the cheese board. Sorry. Is there any rules of thumb about matching, say, dessert wines with food? I've sort of heard people talk about, you know, making sure the dessert wine is sweeter than the dessert.
No, I mean, to me, it's a question of balance again. If the dessert is so rich, you need acidity in the sweet wine.
Yep.
Even though it's sweet, you can have a lovely level of freshness, like Riesling produces or some Jurançon produces. If the dessert is not so sweet, I wouldn't overdo it with a very heavy and cloying sweet wine, basically. You still need balance. Like I say, and acidity is very much part of the balance in the sweet wine, because you feel it when there's lacking of. For instance, apple tart tatin, which I love, go extremely well with, well, Sauternes is one we know, but some of the Austrian sweet wine as well.
Oh, okay.
Some Botrytis Austrian sweet wine are fantastic with, like, the lack of tart tatin. We do at work at, texture, coconut, called a coconut texture, funny enough, which is everything but coconut, but I love this very exuberant fruit of the coconut, which to me I marry very fantastically well with the muscat from Greece, because it's so aromatic as well.
Mm.
So again, back to the flavors and the intensity and the level of sweetness, you need to reflect that into the sweet one as well, but I love the acidity to refresh your palate, to clear your palate at the end. It's very, very important. Any good sweet one in the world will have a lovely level of acidity.
Yeah, I think that's...
It has to.
That's one of the golden rules. It's almost as...
Tokaj, Sauternes, Riesling, obviously, but Tibiet, Rockenberg, and Schles, all sorts. So it's the key. I think acidity is the key there.
One of the things I realized recently is that things like champagne, most people have them as an aperitif, but because of all that acidity in it, it actually goes quite well with a lot of food.
Yeah, I mean, we do a fish and champagne tasting menu.
Yeah.
So we've got 5 courses, fish-based, and 5 different champagne.
Yeah?
Yeah. And it goes extremely well. I've been to Champagne a few times, and they obviously, when you go there, they entertain you with champagne, champagne, champagne. And the beauty of that, it makes you feel so much lighter as well towards the end of the meal. Yet the acidity can be on the higher end as well when you finish the meal. But overall, you feel great. You feel light. Light-headed and light body as well.
Okay. Aperitif, you know, what's the key thing with an aperitif?
Not to ruin your palate.
Yeah?
In France, there's a famous aperitif called Pastis or Ricard, which is anise-based. And my God, it's powerful.
Yeah.
Basically, anything after that, you can't taste.
Yeah.
So something settled. I mean, gin and tonic in this country is very famous, and there's nothing wrong with that because it refresh your palate with the tonic.
Yep.
A glass of champagne or sparkling wine, as we said, because again, it's the acidity, and the acidity opens up your stomach as well. It makes you a bit more hungry.
Oh, really?
I don't know if you know. Yeah. Aperitif comes, aperir, I think the word aperir comes from the Latin, which means opening.
Mm-hmm.
So it opens up your appetite. Aperitif.
Okay, so something with a bit of acidity to...
Acidity, it makes your stomach work and your liver work. So it opens up. It's very well known that as soon as you drink something with a bit of acidity, you start to be hungry.
You mentioned a couple of times about the weight of the wine and you talked about, you know, maybe not having something too powerful early on. Is it important to build the weight of the wine through the meal?
Yeah, it's like why do we go for meat after fish? The only reason why is the power. Because technically, who tells you to do first fish and then meat? You can go for lamb followed by salmon, technically. But if we don't do it, because in terms of power, because you know very well your salmon won't taste much after the lamb. No. Same thing for the wine. You go in terms of power, from the lightest to the most powerful. It doesn't mean, because again, we do white wine after red. It doesn't mean the white have to come first. Because some light Pinot Noir and the Viognier
or Beaujolais
and some pretty creamy, heavy, spicy white wine can go very well after that.
Yeah, yeah. Big, heavy-oaked Chardonnay is a lot heavier than a light red.
Yeah, exactly. So it doesn't have to be white first and red to follow. It could be anything.
A wine that I really hardly ever think about pairing with food is rosés. Mm-hmm. You know, I always think of rosé more as a sort of sitting around drinking a few glasses.
So do I, actually.
Yeah?
So do I. If I do it in the summer and it tastes fantastic because you're on holiday and you relax. But in terms of pure food and wine matching, it can go well with, you know, nice foods from, you know, Italian style or Mediterranean style of food. I wouldn't do a whole evening on different rosé. I would find that a bit one-dimensional.
Yeah. Oh, no.
There is some differences, obviously, between different rosé from the Provence to Spain to Italy and New World, some lovely Australian rosé. But overall, I wouldn't do a whole evening on matching rosé and food, no. I'll find that, like I said, a bit one-dimensional.
Just to wrap up, what sort of wines are quite trendy in the restaurant scene at the moment?
Grapes or wines or
regions? Both. Regions, grapes, varieties. Just what you think is taking
up and coming,
a few years ago, Viognier was starting.
Viognier still is, actually.
Yeah.
Viognier still is. Grüner Veltliner from Austria still is. Albarino, I find, from Spain.
Yeah.
I love that style. I love Albarino. So that's one. And I think in terms of country, I would say Portugal. Is one to watch, definitely.
Yeah.
For his red first, forget the fortified red like port, but for the red and the white will eventually follow. But this is probably the most interesting country at the moment in Europe. And they are doing a lot at the moment to get the word out there as well.
I tasted a wee while ago Marsan, 100% Marsan, last October. It's the first time I've had it as a single varietal. And I really liked it. It reminded me of sort of somewhere between an Albarino and a Viognier, you know, but with more acidity. You know, it didn't have that weight that Viognier has. It was fresher.
I love Marsan, but it's not everybody's taste, though. I think you need to be a bit more of a wine connoisseur to like 100% Marsan. It's not everybody's cup of tea. I love that. And like I said, I'm originally not far from the Rhône Valley, which is Saint-Joseph, which is Marsan-based, so, you know. So that's my style. But I love it. I don't think there's more and more planting, unfortunately, but I understand it's quite a difficult grape also to grow. Hence why it's not many people risk it.
Okay, then. I think we'll wrap it up there, Xavier.
Okay, thank you very much.
Cheers very much. With Christmas nearly upon us, food and wine matching is always useful. This year, the backbone of my Christmas wines are going to be Otago Pinots. I've got loads of them between 3 and 7 years old that I've been meaning to get through. But for whites, I have an absolutely gorgeous Sancerre that I'm going to be drinking for the lighter dishes, and a lovely Californian Viognier for those heavier dishes. Loads of fruit going on there. And to finish up with, I'm going to have a nice bottle of Takai Azu. Very rich, and it's such a shame that my father-in-law is a diabetic. Yeehaw! Which means I get to drink a lot more of it. Otherwise, he would just hoover it up given half a chance. Now, I have a big thank you to Andrew Cheeseman, who pointed out that I made a mistake in show 135. The audio file I'd used for that show was from show 134, so you may have pulled down that show 134 a couple of times by mistake. Now, I've updated the notes and the RSS feeds, so you should be able to pull down show 135. In fact, my iTunes automatically pulled it down once I'd updated the file. So you may find in your RSS reader, you may have two shows, 135. The second one is the one that is real. Next week, Christmas will be over for another year, and we finish our chat with Joseph Buchan from Freshenet. But before we finish up, let's have a listen to the quote again. Claret is the liquor for boys, port for men, but he who aspires to be a hero must drink brandy. How did you get on? Well, the person in the quote is perhaps most famous for his dictionary, but it was not the first or the largest dictionary. But it just happens to be the most used English dictionary until the Oxford English Dictionary came along in 1928. Woo! How's that for a nice, interesting tidbit of fact? The person I'm talking about is Samuel Johnson. So until next week, cheers!
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.